Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. You may have heard of the pink tax. CPA Janine Rogan argues that it goes beyond just women paying more for certain things than men. She takes us through her new book, The Pink Tax, Dismantling a Financial System Designed to Keep Women Broke. Then, financial fraud and human trafficking, how victims can be affected by coerced debts. Equifax Canada President Sue Hutchison tells us more about this issue and what needs to be done to protect human trafficking survivors. And if you rent, you might be looking around for tenant insurance. But what do you do if you get a really high quote? Grant Clark from BrokerLink is here to talk about what to do if that's the case and the things to look for as you're sorting out a policy. Plus, navigating some of the financial challenges that seniors face. Caitlin Verge lived on a senior's budget for a month. It was a pretty brutal experiment and a real eye-opener for her. She's here to talk about it, the experiment specifically, and some of the lessons she learned. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. The dry cleaners. That is the example that used to really get to me. Despite the fact that my dress shirt is about the same amount of fabric as a woman's blouse, I paid less. Men pay less for lots of different things, and women, on average, not only pay more for stuff, but they get paid less than women do, than men do, rather. And these are just a couple of things that chartered professional accountant Janine Rogan explores in her new book. It is called The Pink Tax, Dismantling a Financial System Designed to Keep Women Broke. Janine joins us now from Calgary, Alberta. Hello there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on your book. It's a big milestone. And I would summarize by saying it is a much more in-depth look than I alluded to with my overly simplistic example. But first, describe for us what you mean by the phrase the pink tax.
Absolutely. So the pink tax actually started out of some research done around gendered products. So you're absolutely right. Things like the dry cleaner, things like razors, shampoo, you know, we see examples in kids' helmets, kids' clothing. Really, it extends kind of throughout all of the spending we do in our society. But what I really wanted to do with this book is look at kind of the impact of all of the systemic kind of decisions we've made as a society that impact women and their ability to earn money as well as build wealth. So there's just so many examples of how there is inequality in our financial system and how women end up paying more for all of these things.
You structured your book in a very clear way, which illustrates a call to action in each part. The first is around demanding financial equality, and you argue for a new lens. We need to look at this through a new lens. What's the new lens?
I mean, I think when we look at how we've always had our financial system set up, it is taboo to talk about money. Millennial and younger generations just need to work hard and then they'll be rewarded and be able to buy a house. And women basically just need to, I guess, accept the jobs that they have and be grateful for them. So, there's a lot of new ways we can start to look at this, but I think we need to start looking at, again, how our system is set up to disadvantage women, as well as what we've done in the past, let's say for different generations, may not be what we need to actually do going forward.
Payment isn't biased, you say, but the payer is. So I'm assuming you're talking about employers here. What is a way for employers to check their biases at the door, to tweak or transform their compensation frameworks?
You know, that is a really great question. And there's a lot of things that employers can do. I think number one is pay transparency. So when we look at even different countries around the world, we can see that there are pay transparency laws around companies being required to actually publish their pay gap data. And then they actually need to do something with that data. So once they have the data that says, you know, okay, women are being paid less, or this individual is identified as being paid less than their male counterpart, what are they actually going to do about it? And we've seen some tech companies actually try to address the wage gap. And what they've found is they actually need to be addressing it every 6 months to make sure that everyone is on that equal playing field.
Every 6 months? Are you telling me that it gets out of whack if left untended? We can't just fix the root cause and have it take care of itself?
Absolutely, because you know people are getting promoted and people are getting bonuses and people are being hired, and there's bias in hiring practices, there's bias in bonus payments. So we really have to, until this becomes normal, we have to take a critical lens on it and look at it often, because again, yeah, fixing it once isn't gonna do it for the long term.
Your first part around financial equality really sets, I think, a compelling and different context for part two, which is maybe a little more traditional personal finance kind of how to, and that's around building wealth for self-care. Why was this important in a conversation about the pink tax?
I think often women aren't as involved in their finances, and there's a lot of different reasons for this. I think predominantly it goes back to, as a society, how we've told women not to talk about money, how little girls versus little boys are raised. They've actually found a pay gap in allowances. We get to this point as women where we are working a full-time job and maybe we're spending more than we should, or we don't know how to save, or we don't know how to invest. And this causes, for anybody, a lot of stress. And we know that money is a number one stressor for a lot of different people. And so really where I went with the notion of self-care is, don't get me wrong, I love a bubble bath, I love a glass of wine, but at the end of the day, doing the hard thing of getting involved with your finances and getting yourself set up so that you aren't stressed every day about money, or you aren't worried about opening the bill that comes in the mail or in your email, I think is such a strong way of advocating for yourself and creating self-care to ultimately lower your stress, maybe your financial anxiety, as well as financial shame.
Including the challenge, this section includes the challenge of ask for more. What is the single biggest piece of advice you have on that topic for people?
I think when we look at that chapter and we look at asking for more, it really does come down to looking at your income and how you can increase that. I mean, it's a personal finance debate as to whether you should increase your income or cut your expenses. And I think there can be room for both. But at the end of the day, women on average are paid, white women on average, pardon me, are paid just 84 cents on the dollar. And when we look at women of color, it's 62 cents. So we really do need to ask for more when it comes from the jobs we work, but also when it comes to our partners and our financial advisors, continue to ask those questions and have those conversations so that we can create financial equality.
Part three is around supporting new mothers. And, you know, I am a parent, but I'm in a two dad parent relationship. So I have no context for what it is to be a new mother, but I do have a great deal of context about what it's like to be the primary caregiver, just with the privilege that comes alongside being a white male. What perspective do you think that we need to understand more universally about the challenges new moms in particular face?
I think number one being, when you give birth to a child, that is a medical procedure, or sometimes it's a large abdominal surgery if you have a cesarean. And so when I look at how we, I guess, treat mothers that have given birth around parental leave and kind of maxing out that benefit at, I think it's $2,000 or just over $2,000 a month, that really isn't, for a lot of people, anywhere close to their monthly salary. And now bombarded with all of these extra costs of having a little one as well as trying to recover. So what I would love to see is an increase in that, more aligned with what people make, so that, you know, women aren't stressed out about money in this time when they've just gone through this major, major life change. And I mean, that extends to all parents, but I think from a medical perspective, it does really impact women.
No matter how a child comes into your life, if you don't give birth physically, the hormonal changes are they're just different. We'll not say more or less, but they're certainly different if you carried the child and are feeding and all those sorts of things. I think that's accurate and fair. The fourth part, vote for your daughters. I have a child. I really felt this was the call to action for the rest of us, that it is not just something, a mantle that women need to carry alone. What's your message to guys out there?
Well, we absolutely need men to help with the advocacy of equality. And so I think why I titled this section Vote for Your Daughters is sometimes I find men don't know how to help, or they're not sure what to say, or they're worried about saying the wrong things. And so putting it in the context of someone that they love and care for, so whether that's a daughter, a mother, a sister, putting that lens on it, I think then maybe allows them to kind of have a purpose when it comes to some of this advocacy work, because you wouldn't want that for your daughter. You wouldn't want your daughter to be passed over for a promotion or to be paid less. You probably think that your daughter is amazing and fantastic and should be equal to all of the men she's working with. And so that is really kind of what I wanted the call to action to be for that, and to really have men empathize with what is going on for women when it comes to inequality.
You opened this book with a quote from Gloria Steinem: "The truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off." What of all the things that you covered and uncovered in this book raises your ire the most?
Well, I mean, that's a long list. You should have heard my husband while I was writing this book. There would just be cursing from upstairs about all
this. I just found the data on this. It's infuriating. Yes, dear.
Yes. I mean, I really think the wealth gap is the one that gets me the most, because there is such a large gap. And ultimately, when I think of wealth, that is what translates into power. And what can we do with power? We can choose what kind of companies we want to invest in, how we want to make an impact. We can, you know, become political leaders and advocate for policy change. We can create scholarships for those that are, you know, less fortunate or less privileged than us. And I just think that, you know, women not having equality when it comes to money and ultimately power is doing a disservice to the globe. So I would say that's probably the thing that makes me the most mad.
I want to finish on an optimistic note, or at least we'll try to. And that is the second last thing you write about before acknowledgements is the future is equal. Looking ahead to the future, and you choose your time horizon, if it's 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, I don't know. What are some things that you would put out to the universe as having changed in that time?
I mean, if it was up to me,
it's up to you. It's up to you.
Yeah. I think number one is all companies have to publish their wage gap data and do something about it. Otherwise we fine them. They do this in Iceland. So I think that's number one. I think our minimum wage needs to be indexed a lot higher to inflation and what it would be if it had kind of kept up, so that we can start to push stagnating wages up. And then I would say probably maternity leave and parental leave benefits are actually kind of a living wage for parents while they're on leave. And then in conjunction with that, all daycare is free. So just a short few things.
I mean, we'll do that by tomorrow. What about after that? I'm kidding. It is a tall order. It is an ambitious agenda. And I think it's so fantastic that you have laid it out so clearly and in such a compelling way. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you.
Janine Rogan is the author of The Pink Tax: Dismantling a Financial System Designed to Keep Women Broke. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, kind of a related story, but a particular spin on it, human trafficking. And that is a very much a gendered phenomenon. Human trafficking and financial fraud. I'll speak with Sue Hutchinson. She is president of Equifax Canada. We will talk about the problems and some of the solutions. And later, some a little simpler, tenant insurance. When you live somewhere unconventional, it can be tough to get. It can be expensive to get. Grant Clark, Vice President of National Personal Insurance at BrokerLink. We'll be here to talk about that. To stay up to date with all things Moolala, you can sign up to our newsletter. It has the stuff that we do here on Sirius XM, CBC Radio, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. Just go on over to moolala.ca and sign up for that. Comes once a month. We will do nothing with your with your email address other than send you a newsletter once a month.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Financial fraud is a really, really serious problem. It affects individuals, it affects organizations, it affects relationships. And unfortunately, for victims of human trafficking, they're even more susceptible to fraud and sometimes are coerced into taking on additional debt. Sue Hutchinson is the president of Equifax Canada, and she joins us now to talk about this issue, the problem, some of the solutions out there, and why Equifax is supporting some legislation to look to protect survivors. Hello there, Sue.
Hi there, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. I want to ask first off if you could give us some context for this challenge in Canada. How many people does it affect? How significant would you say an issue is it for those who are harmed in this way?
So I guess the big picture, Bruce, is, you know, fraud is a big issue. And fraud has accelerated because of COVID and really the digital transformation that so many companies have gone through. But just kind of by the numbers, overall fraud is up about 40% from 2021 to 2022. In numbers, that's gone from about $380 million, this is just here in Canada, to about $530 million in actual losses. So it is a big issue, an accelerating issue, and it's, you know, highly concerning and obviously connected to cybersecurity. It's often the bad guys. So, you know, in the context of our mission and vision, which is really helping people live their financial best. And so as the president of Equifax Canada, mine is helping Canadians live their financial best. You know, one of the groups that's very harmed in many ways of their lives are survivors of human trafficking. And as they go through that, you know, horrendous recovery, the financial recovery becomes often a big issue. So just in terms of human trafficking, I guess there were, you know, there's about sort of 2,000 cases a year. And unfortunately, that is also growing. Unfortunately, most of it is accounted for by sex trafficking, and most of the victims are women.
And it would probably be not too large a stretch to say that number is underreported, because I can imagine there would be many victims for whom it would be difficult to come forward, and they would have to be weighing the cost versus benefit on coming forward. I want to ask a nuanced question on the issue, and that is around this idea of coerced debt, because pure financial fraud, someone stole my identity, they took out a card in my name, they used that card, kind of easy to see, it's black and white. In the case of human trafficking, though, you could have an individual who is forced to take on debt, but they were in the room when it happened, they were aware that it happened, powerless to do anything about it. How do you understand the shades of gray there?
Right. So the, you know, the proposed legislation that we're supporting, first of all, is, you know, being read in the House, will likely go into legislation in the spring or summer of this year. It was supported by all four parties, which is quite unusual. But what it does, it introduces this concept of coerced debt, as you said, Bruce. So what that means is it's when you're under the control of traffickers, you're forced to take out, or they take out debt in your name, and sometimes you're involved in the process. And it's often because most of these victims, let me just look at my notes here, I think they're 72% are under the age of 25. So they're quite young. So the kind of debt that gets taken out in their name is usually credit card debt. Sometimes it's student loans. And, you know, the average debt is close to $30,000. So wow. For people coming out and trying to recover from that, that is just a tremendous burden. So the concept of coerced debt was introduced because, of course, as a credit bureau, we do forgive fraudulent debt. It's often quite a process. People have to, you know, prove it. We have to get validation. This process should be somewhat easier. There's also, it's also supported by a tribunal. But effectively, what the legislation does is that no lender can adjudicate based on this coerced debt. It has to be forgiven. No collection agency, either directly by the lender or outsourced, can go collect on this debt. And it will be removed from your credit file. We've done some similar work in the US as well. So we're very supportive of, you know, this really, really sad issue and this segment of the population that have to deal with it.
I was the victim of fraud a year ago, and I have every privilege there is in terms of education and gender and financial literacy and all those things. And there are still errors on my credit file that I cannot get changed. For all the power and the follow through that I have, the fraudster's phone number and address are still on my file. What needs to happen to make it easier for people to report and follow through on the correction on these things?
Yeah. So I guess speaking for Equifax, you know, we're trying to make a lot of improvements in how we're dealing with some of these issues, and whether people are calling because things are just mistakes, or, you know, someone, you know, sometimes we have the same name, the father and son, and the report gets, you know, mixed. You know, we're moving our technology to cloud technology with a lot of machine learning and AI. It's much smarter to try to find these errors that sometimes happen. We have, you know, improved, I think, adjudication process where we're really trying to make sure that we're dealing with kind of these backlogs. I see them. I read some of the customer inquiries. It's highly frustrating. At the same time, we are regulated, so we have to go through a lot of hoops to make sure that it is true fraud. It has been validated. But, you know, I think there's, it's still quite a frustrating process. So I apologize for that if we're part of your frustration.
What is the opportunity of artificial intelligence as you look to the future, and in particular, as it relates to human trafficking and financial fraud? What are the indicators that might illuminate to a bureau such as yourselves that there's something going on that would fit with a particular a pattern of behavior?
Yeah, and you know, it's a lot. It's not just, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning. It's also the, you know, latest and greatest technology. So just to give you a real life example, you know, Equifax is moving all its technology to cloud globally, and actually Canada's leading the way. And so if you kind of think of, you know, old tech versus new tech, just roughly, not getting too technical, you know, old tech is usually batch overnight processes, you know, chugging away in a data center on maybe mainframe technology, et cetera. So it's slow. It's not real time. We have a lot of what we call kind of fragmented files. And this would be like S. Hutchison and Sue Hutchison and Susan Hutchison. And, and maybe in the old world of technology, those things don't get combined. So maybe numbers and the fraudster's name and things don't get picked up as easily. So on the latest and greatest technology, which we now have at Equifax, and a lot of you know, AI and machine learning embedded, we're finding things faster. Equifax has run a fraud consortium for many years in this country, about 15 years. And we just moved it all onto a new platform. It's cloud-based, it's real-time. So we're finding things faster, the performance is faster, we're, you know, the data is being connected better, you know, the processing power is higher. So all of these things will find anomalies in the data much quicker, much faster than old tech or human beings, frankly. So a lot of our modeling now and our testing is in just a whole different technical environment, which is much superior.
I'm going to use a kind of a cliche word, but it's the best one I can think of. And that is the ecosystem, the credit ecosystem mm-hmm. for victims mm-hmm. of human trafficking. There's lots of players here. There are the social service agencies that may support a woman leaving an abusive relationship. There is government agencies that will help her get her identity back, her documents back under her possession if they've been taken by her perpetrator. There's the credit bureaus, the banks, there's nonprofit credit counseling agencies. From your vantage point, what are the biggest ideas? What is the biggest role that the ecosystem, using air quotes here, needs to take on to make a significant difference with this population?
In their recovery or in the actual crime?
Or in the prevention of the crime, perhaps, too, because I can imagine there's an awareness part.
Yeah. So I'm not an authority on human trafficking, so I can't really comment on what we need to do to protect, which are mostly the female population. So I really can't comment on that. But I think in terms of recovery, where we can play a small role, is really just, you know, understanding the issue. We have, you know, I have a little tiny window and a little more learning than I used to have since we're supporting this. And I think it's about really the whole piece around helping people live their financial best. So we're working on, you know, for example, you know, bringing in new data so that people can actually have a credit file, can have a credit score. We have a lot of underserved populations in Canada that we kind of think everyone's equal and fairness and the mosaic and all this stuff in Canada, but actually there are, you know, many populations, as you know, that are underserved. They're the young folks, they're Black communities, Indigenous communities, new to Canada, right? They come, they have no credit score, and it hasn't been a tradition of the past to bring an international credit file with you. So some of these new Canadians, all of the new Canadians come with no financial background. And of course, while the banks try to do their best, you know, they offer sort of a secured credit card. So if you give us $2,000, we'll give you a credit card with a $2,000 line. And that just doesn't suffice if you're coming with a family and you need to buy a refrigerator and a couch and all these kinds of things. So we're trying to help the ecosystem there in terms of bringing in alternative data. So telco data, mobile phone data, utilities data. So really helping these populations by bringing more data. You know, one of the things I a great example is if you rent an apartment for 10 years and you pay $2,500 a month, and you or you have a mortgage and it's $2,500 a month for 10 years, those rental payments do not contribute to a credit score. And yet it shows capacity to pay, it shows ability to pay, it shows trustworthiness. So at Equifax, we're starting to bring in some rental data and we're starting to look at how do we model that? Because the face of Canadians is changing, right? So you and I probably bought a house, probably bought a car, but the younger generation are renting more. They're using rideshare, they're taking Uber and Lyft, they're not buying cars. Some of them aren't even getting their driver's license. And yet those are some of the traditional pieces of information that we would include in credit scoring. So we have to really modernize how we're looking at this. And we have done so in the US. Equifax has run an exchange with utilities and telco information for 20 years. And lenders will go and look at that and see if there's additional data to help score more people, to help what we say thicken the credit file and give them the ability to borrow. So we're really excited about that. We've been, you know, really working with the industry together to try to make some changes here in Canada.
Really interesting stuff. Sue, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
Sue Hutchinson is the president of Equifax Canada. She was here to talk about a number of things, but principally this issue of human trafficking and financial fraud.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, shopping around for tenant insurance, Grant Clark from BrokerLink takes us through what you need to know, especially if you live somewhere a little unconventional. But first, living on a senior's budget for one whole month. Caitlin Verge is a debt manager and insolvency professional with Grant Thornton. She talks about her experiment and the lessons she learned. I'm the money columnist for CBC Radio, in addition to this show on Sirius XM. And every Wednesday on CBC, we dig into a topic relevant to you, relevant to your financial life. So if you're hanging around the old traditional radio, tune in afternoons on Wednesday.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Once you retire, your income is fixed, right? Like you can't go pull another overtime shift to cover a car repair. And the cost of everything these days presents some real challenges for retirees when it comes to budgeting. Even those who saved a significant nest egg or who have a defined benefit pension plan. To help understand these challenges, Caitlin Verge decided to live on a senior's budget for a month. Caitlin is a debt professional with Grant Thornton, and she joins us now to talk about how it went and what she learned. She's in Halifax. Hello, Caitlin.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me.
Why did you decide to do this in the first place?
Oh, gosh. I think two main reasons. The first being that I talk to these people every day. So I speak with a lot of people in the week, and I speak with a lot of seniors. And they have different situations. Everybody's situation is unique, but there's some themes that come through. So my first initial gut thing was I wanted to give them a voice. I hear it all the time, but it's easy for me to kind of hear it, but not experience it because I'm not on a fixed income. So my first thing was I want to live this experience so I can understand it better and give people that don't have that voice, right?
How did you determine what that income level would be? You would have had to make some assumptions.
Yes. So I did make a lot of assumptions, and you could have went a lot of ways with it, right? Seniors have such different experiences after they retire. Some have savings, some don't. So what I did was I went with what I heard the most. So what I hear the most is CPP, OAS, and the guaranteed income supplement. And what I did, I went on the Government of Canada website and I got the average for those. And that's how I came up with my income. And I've heard much lower, I've heard higher, but those are the ones that I heard most. So that's what I went with.
And for those people who aren't plugged into what those three things amount to, give us a range here. Is that $1,200 a month? Is it, what is it?
Yeah, it depends, right? Because they are calculated differently. Like CPP is based on how much you work, right? How long you were in the working force. But the total average was $2,432. But again, $2,432, but subject to change, right? If you were a two-person household, you might not be eligible for that guaranteed income supplement. So there's different things that are going to impact that, but the average was $2,432 combined.
And then you had to make some assumptions about expenses. I'm sure, first and foremost, how much did you decide would come off the top for rent or mortgage?
Yeah, so that was really, really, really challenging. I'm in the Atlantic provinces. I'm in Halifax. And I wanted to give something that was realistic, but I wanted to be fair. So what I did is I looked up the averages for each of the capital Atlantic provinces. And then I used that to get to my rent number of 1225, right?
1225.
However, 1225. Yeah. But I would say, like, in the area that I'm in Halifax, I think it is closer to about 2000 on average. So it's not even an accurate reflection of what someone's situation could be.
So I know you didn't move into a different house during that time, but you aligned your spending to what you estimated or assumed a senior would have. The first week was easier than the subsequent weeks. So tell us, first off, what happened in that first week?
Yeah. So what happened in that first week? Like, I have a great passion for budgeting, so I was ready. I thought I was going to kill this, right? And the first week, I started off very strong. And I restricted myself, right? And it's something that I tell people not to do, actually, when I talk about building budgets with them in a counseling session. But I restricted myself so that I could fit within my parameters, and it worked for 1 week, right? So I was in that window, and I thought I could sustain it for the rest of the time. But I hit the week, and after the week, it went off the rails a little bit.
And how come it went off the rails?
Inflation. I think I underestimated inflation, right? And I say in my blog piece that I didn't splurge. Like, I wasn't out purchasing things as I normally would. But how I do normally run my life is, if I'm in a store and I pick up a loaf of bread, I might grumble about the cost of the loaf of bread, but I ultimately buy it, right? And so that first week I restricted myself, but as time went on, I was like, oh, I can probably still afford this. So it was really that inflation on everyday items that just completely pushed me over.
How did you factor in some of the annual or biannual expenses that a senior might face that wouldn't show up month to month, that they would need to have a buffer to cover?
So I called that variable expenses. I broke them down into variable and fixed. And I did the same thing I did with the rent. I started to look up averages. So I tried to use food studies, medical expense studies, and it was not a perfect science, right? Like, if you're in certain provinces, you might be eligible for some supportive income. So you might get that medical expense down, or depending on what your health issues are, it might be, you know, hugely higher, right? It might have been a low ball. So I looked up averages and I tried to go with the averages. And then for savings and entertainment, I really went with what I had left. So I had my two numbers left, and I said, you know what? I would never say to anybody, you know, restrict yourself to the point of not experiencing anything. So I'm going to give myself a little bit of an allowance to have some quality of life and hopefully some savings. So those two numbers came from what was left.
I am all admiration that you stuck with it for the month. I really seriously and am impressed that you did that. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you would say you learned?
I mean, I learned a lot. I think that as a professional, especially if you're dealing with folks that have money troubles all the time, I think for me, it was a really healthy check for myself of reality and privilege, right? So that was the biggest thing I took away, is, wow, how privileged am I, the first thing. The second thing was the importance of retirement savings. So it's a huge takeaway. It's like, oh my goodness, like, for people that are my generation, it just highlights an opportunity to put efforts into those retirement savings. And the third thing is that I think we need to bolster our resources for seniors, right? Is that, you know, even with my best efforts, it wasn't enough, right? And when you do the math, actually, I think the highest minimum wage province or territory is the Yukon. And I think they're at like $1,677 an hour. And if you add that up, that would be net less than what this budget is. So my other takeaway is that even though I said this is a senior's budget, really it could apply to a huge demographic of Canadians that are on minimum wage income, other types of fixed income, mat leave, EI, seasonal employment. I think it applies to a lot of people. So it was just a sobering experiment.
Certainly there is a level of empathy that you will have that you wouldn't have had you not done this this experiment, and you have new insight into the dynamics of the income that seniors earn, at least on average. After doing this experiment, what advice do you have for seniors who are in this zone, who are in these circumstances now? It's too late to save more. That ship has sailed. What advice do you have for them now?
Yeah, I think returning to at a basic level, I think returning to the old mainstays, right? Where can I cut? Can I move in with family? Can I get no fee banking, right? Which is possible. Can I get extra government supplements? Can I just go with internet and cable instead of cable and internet? Like, where can I cut my basic expenses in my budget to help navigate this? And I think that my big thing, if somebody's experiencing a constant deficit and a constant issue with debt and growing debt and just really not being able to make ends meet, I think seeking help from trusted professionals like Grant Thornton, other licensed insolvency trustees or other debt professionals that can help you find a solution for this and try to alleviate some of that stress. If I add debt payments on top of this, like I don't know what I would have done if I added debt payments on top of this. So they're not alone and there's help.
How did people in your community, your friends, your coworkers, what did they think about your experiment? What did they have to say?
My coworkers were very supportive. I think they thought I was a little wacky for undertaking it at such a level. I think that my husband thought I was wacky. He didn't participate in the experiment. We pretended we were separated for the month and then we bought our own things. I did my own groceries and went on my own. But they were supportive, right? I think that it's one of those things, it's like kind of the elephant in the room, right? I think we all know it's an issue, but we don't actually delve into what does that experience feel like and what does it actually look like. So they were wonderful. They were supportive. But I think maybe thought I was a little kooky, but I think great results came from it.
As the experiment wound down and you looked forward to the day when you returned to your prior life and your prior way of spending, what is the first thing that you went out and bought outside of the experiment?
That's a funny question. So I actually I'm a pretty avid budgeter for in real life. Like outside of this experiment, I'm pretty strict with my funds. So there was no splurge for me. I really took it, and you could take it as an opportunity to save money. So I did. I was like, great, I've done all this work. I want to take advantage of all the work that I've done. So I didn't really do anything. I did go back to some regular spending habits. So I did, you know, buy the bread in the grocery store and continue to buy those things that I wanted, but I didn't have that big splurge. I took it as, you know, this was a budgeting experiment and I should take advantage of my learning.
Wow. You should see my face right now. Like if I was on a calorie restricted budget, the first thing I would do at the end of the experiment would be to eat an entire chocolate cake with my hands.
Yeah. And that's how most people, like when I speak to people on a day-to-day basis, that's what happens when they restrict the budget, right? Is that they're so restricted, they just go nuts, right? But I think I have a lot of privilege. My husband still did live in my house. So he probably was buying things that I got the benefit of that whole time, right? Nice. So I think I was kind of, it was a light calorie restriction.
Yeah. Very, very interesting, Caitlin. And I appreciate you writing about it and coming to talk to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I think it's awesome that we're having this conversation and getting the messages there.
Thank you, Caitlin. Caitlin Verge is a debt professional with Grant Thornton. She was in Halifax today, and she took an entire month and built a budget based on average income for a senior, based on CPP, OAS, and GIS. She made some assumptions on what housing would cost. And boy, some hard but important lessons learned, both in terms of the big picture and how we support our seniors in this country, and at a micro level too. How do you determine what to buy at the grocery store when you don't have two pennies to rub together? Stay with us. Coming up, Grant Clark from BrokerLink will be here to talk about tenant insurance. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can very easily get caught up by doing one of two things. You can go to moolala.ca, and when you do that, you can look at the name of the guest, the topic that you're searching for, or full episodes. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to podcasts, and download the show, write a review, subscribe, so the next episode just arrives on your device.
Yeah. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Homeowners get property insurance as a matter of course because the mortgage lender requires it, right? But not all landlords require tenant insurance. I think it is for sure a worthwhile expense. It doesn't cost very much, protect you in case something bad happens. But what if you receive a quote that you think is too high? To talk about why this might be the case and what your options might be, we're joined by Grant Clark. He is Vice President of National Personal Insurance with BrokerLink, and he joins us now from Edmonton, Alberta. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Why does someone need tenant insurance in the first place? Make your case here.
Yeah, absolutely. As a tenant, you might find yourself liable for damage you caused to the building or the property, or unintentional harm caused to others who live or visit that property that you're occupying. You know, generally, what drives someone towards realizing their need and the value of the tenant insurance product is their first tenant insurance policy. It's the landlord. Often, you know, a landlord will include it as a condition of their lease or rental agreement, or that concept of tenant insurance will come up while in conversation with an insurance professional. They'll make the recommendation and the customer will consider the protection.
What are some ways in which it would differ from homeowner's insurance? Does a general tenant policy cover the same or similar things?
No, they're quite a different product. With the tenant insurance, you're not covering the physical structure as you would with a homeowner's product. With the tenant insurance, you know, coverage and policy enhancements do vary provider to provider, but the basics you'd want to see in that tenant's policy are pretty similar no matter where you look. You're getting coverage for contents or personal belongings, coverage for additional living expenses, and then the personal liability coverage. So that homeowner's component of that physical structure is definitely absent from the tenant's pack.
I mentioned that it isn't that expensive to get this kind of coverage. At least that's been in my experience. Give us a range here. Say a 30-year-old single person with an average amount of stuff, an average amount of technology, a nice black leather couch or whatever. What are they paying a month?
That individual, in my experience, would be a very average tenant insurance customer. And you'd be looking at about $25 to $45 a month, Bruce.
Yeah. So it's not a lot. Like that's a couple of drinks at a fancy place. And this coming from someone who's quite skeptical about insurance in general. And I always want to make sure people buy the coverage that they for sure need versus, you know, that is simply a bonus or a perk. So this, I think it is easy to justify why people need to have tenant insurance. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about is, when people have a hard time finding coverage, and we use the term unconventional, when they live somewhere unconventional, what are some examples of where people could live where coverage might be harder to get?
Yeah, so one of the rating factors that goes into tenant insurance would certainly be the building that you occupy, regardless if you own it or not, obviously, because it is a tenant product. The building's year of construction, the updates that have been done. So is the heating and the roof and the plumbing and the electrical current? How far is it from a fire hydrant or a fire station? Obviously, you know, an older building that has older services and older electrical, the propensity for there to be a loss is much higher than a newer location. So that would drive that acceptability.
What are some scenarios in which you could be out and out rejected? So not just having to pay more, but where an insurance company would be unwilling to write that policy.
Yeah, say you're an existing tenant insurance customer and perhaps you've had many losses or claims against your tenant insurance policy. That could create challenges in getting that policy issued.
What are some red flags for insurers on the risk of fraud? We talk a lot about insurance fraud, or at least we do on this show. What are some areas in which that would be a concern for an insurance company?
In the context of tenant insurance?
Oh my gosh, you're pausing. Is that to say that it is so rare that you don't even have an answer for me?
No, you know, I didn't come prepared to talk about fraud relative to tenant insurance. And I know you do like your statistics and information, Bruce.
I love that my reputation precedes me. I'm not important for me to have stats. It'd be more like, what are some of the ways in which a holder of tenant insurance might try and skirt the rules or cheat the insurance companies?
Yeah, I mean, we approach everything from utmost good faith in the insurance industry, right? So we have that utmost good faith that the consumer who purchases the product is going to do the right thing and use it for its intended purpose, but that isn't always reality. The scope of the tenant insurance product is generally limited to first party coverage for the most part, which is the things they own and possess. So to me, I would say fraud would occur if there was a claim for personal belongings or items that were lost or stolen or what have you, and perhaps that didn't actually happen.
Right. My Ming vase was broken, and you therefore owe me $850,000.
There you go.
Yeah. If someone is not happy with the quote that they receive, I mean, I am a big advocate for people comparing quotes in all categories of their financial life. What do you do?
So the market offers choice, right? You've got brokers, you've got direct writers, you've got many people who will offer the protection. Of course, in my opinion, the best is an insurance broker. They've got a swath of companies that they can compare the rate for you with and give you the advice that goes with it. Things that drive it, Bruce, the premium up or down would be, you know, the value of their belongings. Do they want a 1 million, 2 million or greater liability limit? The building that we talked about before, how old is it? Is it new? Is it updated? Is it older? Credit history also can play a part in pricing property policies as well. So is the credit history favorable? As well as the claims, the claims history, right? Is it claims free? Do they have a few on their record that we need to consider?
We talk a lot on this program about how people are paid, because it is so helpful for investors to know how advisors are paid, for borrowers to know how mortgage brokers are paid. In the context of tenant insurance, how are insurance brokers paid? Because it's a fairly small dollar ring. Is it even a profitable product for you to sell?
That's right. And I mean, the profitability is driven market by market and market by market would be insurance company and how they price their products. That's unique to the carrier. But from the standpoint of an insurance broker, there's a modest commission earned on the premium for the tenant's insurance policy. It's low. And it's a volume play, right? You want to insure quite a few tenants to earn a good return on that.
What's the percentage?
I think it's
like 5%, 10%.
Yeah, it's in that 10% range.
10%, right. So say it's like $250 a year, the broker's making $25. That's not a big chunk of money versus if they've got your entire suite of other insurance needs, your property, your auto, whatever, that could be a couple of grand and commission would be higher on that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff, Grant. I really appreciate you joining us to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Grant Clark is the Vice President of National Personal Insurance with BrokerLink, and he was here to talk about tenant insurance. It's a pretty important thing if you're a renter, even if your landlord does not insist. It's not a huge amount of money. I think it's worth it. That is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsor, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. To reach us, our email address is ask@moolala.ca, and you can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, any feedback you have on the show. We can't help you find an insurance broker. Go to Google for that. Go to your Facebook page for that. To subscribe to our newsletter, do so at moolala.ca. To subscribe to the podcast, to do so, go to the podcast platform in which you may well be listening to this show right now. On social media, I am at Bruce Sellery, Sellery on Twitter, or Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.